I feel the divide between you and I, like the distance between the dark and light. But just as the dawn is both day and night, maybe I can make you mine, make you mine.
Hey everyone, welcome to Operation Dichotomy, where our mission is to bridge the gap between you and me by embracing a culture of listening. Today, if you haven't been following us on a day-to-day basis, you'll know by now that, I'm sorry, I said that weird. If you have been following us on a day-to-day basis, by now, you'll know that we have been about a week and a half into this campaign called Love Listens, where we are working with Love 146, which is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to end child trafficking and exploitation because we need to. Right, we as a people need to end child trafficking and exploitation. They just happen to be experts in a particular area of that field. We're in the middle of that conversation and the campaign, but today we have just the honor and the privilege of having one of Love 146's very own staff members. Her name is Marilyn Murray. She is the director of communications. I believe she's been with Love 146 since 2009, if I read that correctly. You can correct me if
That's
I'm wrong.
Correct.
Oh, nice.
Yep.
But anyways, Marilyn, thank you so much for being here with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So today, I think what we want to do for our audience and even for myself is to dive into your experiences with Love 146. We don't by any means look at you and be like, hey, you are the organization Love 146. But at the same time, you have a unique experience. In your little over a decade of work with them, you've seen a lot of things that most people don't see. I feel like In many ways, I don't know if this has been sort of a recent phenomenon or if it's just been in my little circle of social media and media, but I feel like there has been more talk about child exploitation and child trafficking. And I feel like more awareness has been rising up. Do I feel that correctly?
I think that's accurate. I think that, since I've been at Love 146, there's been periods where there's like heightened awareness of the issue and that sort of comes and goes. And it's subtle to kind of pick up on. Like, it seems like there's more chatter lately than usual. So the past year has definitely been one of those times.
I wonder why that's the case. I don't know if you'll know or if we'll get into that later, but let's just dive right in because we have so much to share and we want to bring so much wisdom to the audience. First off, how did you end up with Love 146 in 2009? What motivated you to join the organization?
In 2009, I graduated from college. I grew up in Florida and went to college in St. Augustine, Florida at Flagler. And I had studied graphic design, and then I also had studied philosophy and was looking for, I was being sort of reared in my graphic design and advertising program to work for an ad agency. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I wanted a little bit more control over the products that I would be asked to sell. So I got a little bit of a taste of what it was like. You know, we'd get projects that were kind of mock agency projects. And I was like, I don't know if I feel comfortable selling these things. And I started learning more about consumerism and just production and the human costs of that. Exploitation that happens throughout the labor cycles, and decided that I didn't feel comfortable just being put on a job selling anything that the client asked for. And so an ad agency wouldn't necessarily be the right place for me to feel like I was doing my best work. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that I would rather be in-house with one group of people. And really get to know one issue over a longer period of time. So I started applying for communications, but mostly graphic design positions in-house at different nonprofits. And whenever I had an opportunity when I was in college to design something that related back to specifically trafficking, I often was doing that. And so it was an issue that I cared about even when I was an undergrad. And so I was applying for all kinds of positions, and I graduated in 2008, which was a little bit like 2020 in terms of like what the job market felt like.
Right.
And so an internship at Love 146 came on my radar, And while I wasn't looking for internships, I was looking for a job. I decided this particular organization I'd heard of before, and it was so in line with a lot of things that I was passionate about that I was like, I'm just going to do an internship and hope that it can turn into something more. And so I did that in 2009. So I started, when you hear the 09 start date, that's mm-hmm. when I sort of moved up to Connecticut and jumped into the office in a very full-time kind of basis, but as an intern. And did a summer internship, and that turned into a year-long fellowship kind of thing. And then a little less than a year later, I joined staff officially.
Oh, okay. You mentioned back when you were working at the ad agency, you're struggling a little bit with the ethics of it, where you can't really sell everything because you don't believe in everything necessarily. And you mentioned that you saw the cycle of production with some of the things, and you thought about the exploitation and the trafficking. And I don't know if it was that specific in your line of thinking at that time, but do you think that affected you I feel like this idea of wanting to end human trafficking was ingrained in you before you got to Love 146.
I think that thinking about the cost of like constant consumerism and how much money we throw at things, and even some of the dead end sort of cycles of consumerism, like putting our water in bottles and just those types of like conundrums felt mm-hmm. a little bit irritating when I was an undergrad. I wasn't at an ad agency, but we were in my undergraduate program very much being reared to work in an ad agency. That was the job they were getting you ready to go do. Mm-hmm. So that was very much already an issue. And I have like magazine mock, when you're a graphic design student, you do mock layouts and stuff and fake ads and kind of mm-hmm. stuff. So I have mock article layouts of like articles written by Kevin Bales and people that were sort of, wrote some of the foundational, you know, materials on human trafficking when it was originally understood as a crime. So I did as much work as I could and sort of saw that work as like, well, maybe this is building the portfolio that is showing what I'd like to do, but I can at least educate my classmates on this. We have to get up and present our project. So I'll get up and get to present about, you know, human slavery. And so I did that. And then somewhat tangentially, what I didn't think was related at all was being a part in a more personal and not academic way of a group of women that were just processing a history of abuse. And so being in a community long before Me Too or anything was a movement, but being in a community and a group of women that were talking about our own histories of sexual abuse was something that was very much a fixture, I guess, of my life when I was an undergrad. And so when Love 146 came up, it seemed like, man, I have been thinking about a lot of things that are related to this mm-hmm. And people's abuse and its escalation to trafficking and making, you know, becoming a commercial situation isn't necessarily the same thing, but they're hitting some of the same notes. And so that was a draw for me personally too, was that I saw this was an extension of a lot of things that I'd already been thinking and cared deeply about. And it wasn't until I saw the position at Love 146 come up that I was like, wow, I wonder if all of these kind of stories in my life might converge. And that turns out it did. Oh. Yeah, that very much felt like what happened.
So let's talk about Love 146 for a second. I guess, hold on, let's talk about human trafficking for a second. I feel like the bird's eye perspective of trafficking, when your average person, I don't even know if I should call it average person, but when somebody doesn't understand human trafficking, I feel like the process is someone either gets kidnapped or tricked into modern day slavery, as they call it, and they get stuck against their will, whether it's through threat, whether it's through like physical bondage, for whatever reason, they can't get out. That's why it's called slavery. And then when the rescue process comes, I feel like the way that it's portrayed sometimes is that it's this glorious operation that you see in Hollywood where you have these Navy SEALs going into some sort of brothel or some crazy like brothel, I don't know another word for it, and then they rescue these people out of it, And then that's the end of the movie, right? But there's, I mean, obviously there's so much more, which is why I'm asking this question. But along that whole spectrum, okay, first of all, can you tell us the general process of what usually happens from beginning to the quote unquote survivor care? Because I think that's one of the most important things that you guys do in particular. And then as we go through that, like where does Love 146 specialize? Because I do remember reading on the website, and I did a lot of research, so hopefully I'm not going to say anything stupid. The Love 146, somewhere on the information about who you guys are, it says that there's so many intricate parts to the process that it's hard for one organization to be great at all of them. And so Love 146 really focuses on what they're good at and then allows other people and other organizations to focus on what they're good at. So Sorry, I kind of rambled there, but can you walk us through that process a little bit, but then also where Love 146 really specializes?
All right, let's see. So I'm going to back up. I'll jump into where Love 146 lands. But to back up to your question of like, what does this look like? How is it different than what we may or may not have seen? I heard you say, you talked about the rescue experience, and then there was one other word that you used that
glorification of it.
Yeah. And so I just to think about how it sort of becomes this very action movie type kind of narrative is something to kind of consider. I think that I'm gonna at the risk of irritating anybody, I might get a little bit cognitive here. And I mentioned before, some of my background was philosophy. So I have a tendency to kind of get meta about things. And I just want to acknowledge before doing so that these are realities in people's lives and they're not always, you know, these big meta things that all fit together. And a lot of what I'm doing in my work, but also just in who I am, is sort of trying to see how things fit together and poking holes in things and reconstructing them and that kind of stuff. It's part of my own brain. But to sort of frame a little bit, I mean, trafficking is it's an abuse of power. So someone has a vulnerability in their life, and somebody comes in and says, I can make money off of that vulnerability. And so that could be in the form of labor, that could be in the form of having them do commercial sex. But it's somebody coming in and exasperating a power dynamic that they think they can leverage. And so I think it's worth, when I'm thinking in a communications role about how we frame the problem and what's happening and how we can plug into being part of the solution, I want to be careful that we're sort of pushing against those skewed power dynamics and not simply sort of plugging into them. And so I think we have to ask, when a lot of our narratives and imagery and ideas about trafficking, they start in that way, but then when you think about the interventions, they continue in that way in terms of rescue and this idea that the people that come around this victim are their hope and their only hope. I try to avoid, in the ways I communicate about the issue, putting any of our survivor care workers or any of our donors or in a position where the person who's lived through this continues in a narrative that they are vulnerable, powerless, or in desperate need, and maybe doesn't have anything to offer. Try to level that playing field and dignify them as well as dignify the donor. I don't think that putting the donors or our staff in a position where we're the heroes is ultimately going to serve to end child trafficking. I think we have to get into a world where we're not trying to pounce on some of those power dynamics and benefit from them. So even if we're not benefiting from those power dynamics the way a trafficker would, if our egos are benefiting from some of that, I think it's even worth kind of eroding at. And that's, I will say, that's the framework that I would probably be thinking about as a marketing person, as opposed to a survivor care worker that's like, I have stuff to deal with. We have real issues in these kids' lives that we need to work through. And so most of my coworkers are not probably thinking, maybe not thinking about some of those things on a day-to-day basis, or maybe they are, but definitely when I'm thinking about a marketing role and in the power that I have as an intermediary between the work on the ground and how a wider audience is thinking about that work, that's definitely something that I am keeping in mind.
To jump in real quick, it's something that I never really thought about before, where the power dynamic from pre-trafficking to post-trafficking, if it remains the same, where the victim is still essentially the victim, right? The powerless victim, the voiceless victim. And I like how, you know, I read again on the Love on 46, where it's not that these kids, they don't have voices, it's that we can't hear them, right? They're speaking, we just need to shut up and listen to them, which is why the idea of love listens is so important. But, and you might cover this, so if that's the case, I'm sorry, but since I already started, I understand when we are kind of taking away our hero status in order for the victims now in survivorship to grow stronger, to develop a stronger sense of identity, to understand their value and the worth and the fact that they can contribute as well. Is that where the survivorship is focused on, the survivorship care? How does Love 146 practically get these kids, I'm assuming they're mostly kids, to a point where they're no longer a victim, they're no longer the bottom side of a power dynamic, but instead they're able to grow into who they're supposed to be, in a sense?
So to some of the question too of like, how does this look? Where do we come in? Mm-hmm. How does it all fit together? When Love 146 first started, 18 years ago, we were shadowing other organizations. The field was very new. The field of addressing this specifically was somewhat young. And it had only been defined as a crime by the UN and the US about 2 years before we were founded. And so before that, trafficking wasn't understood widely as a specific crime. And there were organizations when we shadowed with some other organizations that were beginning the work. I wasn't a part of this. This was our co-founders. One thing that they heard from people was, and these were groups that were, when I mentioned some of that, like, where do we want to jump in first? A lot of us want to do the rescues. A lot of us, you hear people, if you go talk about Love 146 and the issue, you stand at the back table with brochures afterwards. The number one, you know, request coming in is like, where can I kick in some doors and punch some traffickers? And so a lot of work in the trafficking field began like that. And there still is a lot of organizations that are doing that, and they're supporting law. Mostly what that work looks like is supporting law enforcement in local places as they go in and do interventions. And so there's a good amount of people engaging in that way. And frankly, law enforcement is engaging in that way, even when there's not organizations specifically supporting it. And so what we find is that, or what we found then was that they were saying, we could intervene in more situations, but where would we put the children? What safe place would they go to? They would just be re-trafficked, or they would move back into unsafe situations. And so that seemed like the biggest gap back in 2002. And so we began our work by initially supporting other organizations that were doing survivor care, aftercare work, and then not long later hiring an expert in survivor care. Her name's Dr. Gundalina Velasco, to begin our own programs. And so we have a couple of safe homes in the Philippines that she is still the person running. And then we've started work in the US and in the UK, both doing survivor care work. And so it looks a little different in both places. In the Philippines, we have two safe homes, one for girls and one for boys, because it does happen to boys too. And those are both specifically serving victims of sex trafficking and child sex trafficking. So in all of our programs, when the youth come into our care, they're under 18, they're victims of child trafficking. But our services don't stop at 18 for those youth. And there are programs that say, you know, like we serve up until age 18. But we continue to journey with youth for as long as it takes, and we're always available. So the same youth that were in our survivor care program when I joined the organization in 2009 are youth that I still see updates about, because our survivor care workers are still keeping, you know, touching base, keeping track. And in the Philippines and the US and the UK, one thing that all the youth in our programs, I say youth a lot, this is my like angle, but some of them are older than me, know is that they can call, they can reach back out if they're feeling vulnerable again, or if they need support, or they want to celebrate. They know that there's Love 146 team that they're connected to, and they can call. So we do find that a lot of youth reach back out. And especially during COVID, we had youth that were experiencing some of those vulnerabilities that could be a real danger to being re-exploited, or just, yeah, making them extremely vulnerable. And so that we were able to jump in and provide very practical rent, food, things like that over the past year.
Okay.
So that's what survivor care looks like here.
It's, I think, obviously it's very extensive, and your knowledge on it is very extensive. But I think what I would want the audience to understand, and this is kind of what I understood from all of that, was the main thing is, you know, you have a roundhouse in the Philippines, because it makes sense, right? For the lack of systems there and the people who are escaping trafficking in that cultural background, it makes sense. But to take that same system and bring it over to the United States, where everything is essentially different, minus the fact that somebody was trafficked, it doesn't make sense all of a sudden. So it's incredibly important for us, even in this arena of ending child trafficking and exploitation, to realize that it's not a one-size-fits-all solution to each individual person. Even though the problem is terrible, we have to be able to listen to each individual case, realize what they need, and act appropriately based on their behalf, not the classic, hey, I'm in a position of power, therefore I know what should be done, and so just do as I say. I think for me personally, to see an organization such as Love 146, a nonprofit who's supposed to be helping this group of people, humble themselves enough to be able to listen to what's actually going on and adjust their plans accordingly, that was huge for me when I learned that about you guys. One of the main themes that I see over and over from Love 146 is this idea of defiant hope. And it's interesting, two words put together. On one hand, you're rebellious. On the other hand, you're hopeful. But I feel like it encompasses the idea of Love 146 so well. Can you tell us a little bit about what defiant hope means and why that kind of became the motto almost?
Defiant hope has always been in our values as an organization. Some people use the word hope and expect it to mean something that you sort of passively wish for. Like, I hope it doesn't rain today for my barbecue. Like, I hope your travel goes well. And it's just sort of like, can't control it. You know, like, what are you going to do? Like, you gotta hope it goes well. When we say hope, defiant hope means more of an active pushing for the world that you want to see. It's not optimism either. It's not denying the reality. Sometimes people think hope is optimism, just sort of like rose-colored glasses and like being hopeful. And this isn't that either. It's as fully as you can looking at the dark reality of the situations before you. And even when those feel overwhelming, pushing back and insisting that every step you can take to push back against that is worth it. So it's a little bit of a muscle, we think, to truly hope, and hope in a way that doesn't avoid the dark realities, but steps into them. And so we're trying to sort of build that muscle of staying hopeful, not giving into despair or cynicism.
Do you feel like that differentiates Love 146 from other organizations in human trafficking? Like, I don't want to talk bad about anybody, but it does seem like Love 146 focuses more on the hope and the positive, whereas I've seen other organizations, not all of them, but enough where I get an idea of, I feel like so. And I get why they do it too, to create that sense of urgency. But I feel like they almost sensationalize the pre-trafficking, the pre-rescue mm-hmm. part in order to get people to move. And then they don't focus on the afterwards. And I'm sure that has implications as well that you understand way better than I do. But mm-hmm. going back to my question, do you think that's something specific to Love 146 that you guys do pretty uniquely?
I think that when we talked before about what role Love 146 has, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of different roles, I think that I do see it as helpful or a luxury or help. Yeah, that Love 146, we do survivor care, and then we also do prevention, trying to prevent it from ever happening in the first place. And I think that those are two pretty hopeful places to be in the field. And so if you're in investigations, I think that I want hope for you, and I want that to be a muscle that you can build. And I hope that the stories that we tell help people on the end of that, in those trenches, also find hope. But I do understand that there's organizations that are that spend most of their time in the dark spots. And I think that, you know, Love 146 does, we work watching kids reclaim their lives every day. I mean, that said, there are youth that have, you know, good youth, or, you know, like our clients, survivors are people, they have good days and bad days. And it's hard on the bad days to always like be like, hey, just stay hopeful. And that's not the point. The point is that to show up and sit with that is an act of hope. I do think that on a marketing level, like when you see a lot of dark stuff being pushed more, I'll go back to that ad agency rearing that I had. I think that one thing that we were taught in advertising and marketing classes was that you needed to make people a little itchy. And this is the best way to put it. I don't know if anyone used that word, but you basically can say, you know, if I had to sell a big speedboat, I need to make sure that you feel inadequate without it. And that's how I'm going to sell you that speedboat. And so I give you an itch and I tell you how to scratch it. And that's what an effective ad will do all at once, is make you be like, oh, my teeth aren't really white, are they? They could definitely be whiter. Like, give somebody an itch and then tell them, like, I can solve all your problems. That's what effective marketing is going to do. And so, or most, that's what the playbook looks like. And so when it comes to charities, especially human rights or anything, the best way, quickest way to make somebody itchy is to show them something horrendous and tell them that you can fix it if you just give $5 or whatever it is. Like, we mostly just need you, we're shaking you down for money, and we'll show you the thing that will be the itchiest thing we could possibly get you to see, and then we'll tell you you can fix it if you just give money. And a lot of that goes, when I mentioned those power dynamics, a lot of it goes back to putting the child in a position where they're, frankly, objectified. Like, it's commodification a little bit. They're sort of a prop used to make you uncomfortable and extract some money. And I think that a lot of charity marketing efforts use that tool. And so it's something that I think is problematic in any case, if you're there trying to promote the dignity of people and how, you know, whatever they need, regardless of the field. But I think that if you're fighting against human commodification and abuse of power and skewed power dynamics, and if I see those as some of the core, like, messed up stuff that is driving trafficking and human exploitation, that I don't want to use those same tools in our marketing efforts. We want to find different things we can use. And so I think that what we all really need is to know that the actions we take matter. And we don't want people to sugarcoat it. But we also need people to be able to recognize trafficking when they see it. Some of the costs of that kind of marketing is that you won't recognize human trafficking if you saw it in your community, if you saw it on the street. If you were a jury member trying to convict a trafficker and you were looking for trafficking to look like some of the advertisements that you had seen, you may not be able to really have compassion for the reality and the complexity of someone's victimization, even though it is clearly victimization. You might be quicker to victim blame if we simplify every story. Yeah, I think there's costs to marketing it in the most extreme scenarios.
I think that what I appreciate the most is just hearing about the integrity and the consistency. It's like, you know, we want to help these people, and we want to be aware of the power dynamics, and we don't want to use them. And even in our efforts to help them, we refuse to do that. Like, we want to tell their stories the best possible way. And this idea of defined hope, I think, is like a really beautiful one. And so kind of like how we came into this, right, is that we were partnering on a project, and we partnered with an artist, Shin Meng, to do this design. We're an apparel company, for those of you who didn't know. And so the idea was, we wanted to design this shirt that kind of represented the idea of Love 146 and Love Listens. And honestly, when we started, we didn't know who we were going to partner with. Shin's, we were connected 3 years back in Boston days. And when we got in contact with him and said, hey, would you be interested in doing this? We literally just like DM'd him. He had no idea who we were. And then he was like, oh, I love 146 and I know Marilyn. And there was just like this crazy, like, small world connection that happened all of a sudden. Have you seen Shin's design at all?
I have seen it for this project just recently, yes.
Yeah, yeah, okay, cool. I have two questions, right? One is like, could you just talk about your connection with Shin? And that's just a fascinating thing. And then secondly, like, yeah, what were your thoughts on the design? And if you don't remember what it was, I'm sure Paul could somehow pop it up real quick. But
I'm trying to remember what year I met Shin or how long ago it was, but it wasn't too long after I came to New Haven. It was probably 2011 or so. But Shin and I specifically met in a group of people that was meeting at my house at the time. And we were, it was artists of all sorts. So visual, music, poetry, sculpture, dance, fiber, all kinds of things coming together. And we, I came up with this format where we would, everyone brought a piece of art, and we shared what we created, and then we would swap pieces. So I would take somebody else's, you know, poem, and somebody would take my photograph, and we'd spend about an hour spread out around my home creating a new piece of art inspired by the one that you took from someone else or borrowed. So using theirs as a source of inspiration, then we would circle back up and show them. So we called it Artist Circle. So Shin started coming to that group, and my first memories of what the things that Shin brought were drawings. He brought them in sketchbooks, but then he often would pick up a piece of cardboard from around our house, a box that got delivered or something. And it was all just a Sharpie pen and a piece of cardboard often. And the things that he made were absolutely mind blowing. And so we were just like, this is in you. Like, this is, that was just insane. And I know several people that we realized, like, the group was for all levels of artists. If you've, you know, if you just have a sketchbook or a notebook where you write, you know, your thoughts, and you haven't had a place to put it or a place to hang it or things like that, this was a place where that art found, you know, a purpose, and it inspired somebody. And so it was a useful group. And I think in helping a lot of us realize that we actually are artists and figuring out whatever that meant. And so at the time, Shin was not practicing art in any kind of full-time way. And I can't speak for him, but I think that the experience that we all shared in Artist Circle was significant for him and others in realizing, like, that deep down we are, a lot of us are artists came to that group. Shin over the years definitely has remained an extremely powerful and prophetic voice in my life, and I'm sure many people's lives. And I think his power in the world has continued, like, just his power has kept growing and growing. I'm humbled to be a friend of Shin's, for sure.
That's so cool. And you said you got to see the design, right?
Yeah, Paul showed it to me not long before I started the call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it does, it looks a lot like some of the youth in our programs. And I can see in some ways the faces of specific kids that I've met in our safe home on this young woman. And I think the most powerful thing I see about it is just this sense of radical dignity that the person has. I think the eyes and the expression on the face is pretty powerful. I think dignity is the best word that comes to mind. And this is a person that, as a person of faith, I can say this is a person that, you know, God made. I think that this image definitely highlights that.
One of the things that's really important to us, right, is this idea of listening. I'm sure Paul's talked about it. And if anyone has heard Operation Dichotomy, like, we really do believe in trying to connect the world by embracing a culture of listening. And so, Marilyn, like, what, like, right now, if we were to be like, this is the opportunity for us to listen, right, to hear from someone who has close proximity and is doing meaningful work in the world to change, you know, this horrible injustice that happens all around us. Like, what would you want us to hear? Like, what would you want our listeners to listen to or be aware of?
I consistently have sort of different epiphanies over the years of working at Love 146 about what inspires me to keep going. And a couple of years ago, I got a cab ride from somebody, and it was an older man, and he asked what I do, and I said, I work in marketing. And he was like, oh, what are you marketing for? And I was like, okay. And so I mentioned that I work for an organization that fights child trafficking. And he said, that is, wow, you know, just good on you. Like, that's amazing. You know, that's such a big issue these days. I can't believe how problematic that is. And it wasn't like that when I was little. This is, I don't know what's going on with the world. And I hadn't quite put it this way until he said that, but I was like, it definitely was happening when you were little. It was absolutely happening. And this man was probably 70. And I was like, what I find really encouraging, I know it feels dark to, you know, to realize that it's happening now at a level that maybe was never realized before. But what I find really encouraging is that, that people didn't have support when you were little. That's the difference, is that the people that went through this might've just been called bad people, might've, you know, been dismissed. Many probably put in jail, even though they were victims. But it's definitely, just because we can see the problem doesn't mean that the problem is getting worse. And in fact, our ability to see the problem is the means by which it begins to get better. And so the discomfort that you feel when you see the problem shouldn't be confused for this feeling that, like, the problem is getting darker and we're all spiraling downward. And in fact, our refusal to tolerate this in the world is new relatively as humans. I look at, like, we watch, I mean, I'm sure any of us in the past year have, like, watched movies that we watched growing up in the 90s or in the 80s and saw things and you were like, you just cannot make a joke like that anymore. That is not okay. And not just on a politically correct level. It's just like, that's just not good human. It's not right. Being a good human. And it's fascinating. Like, you know, when I was growing up, you went to Denny's and people just smoked, like, right next to you in the restaurant. And now it's like, people think that's disgusting. Like, we look at how all these humans decided, like, you know what, this is gross. Like, we can do better. We can do better, humans. Like, and part of that, I think there's things that, people didn't used to be able to vote. And children didn't used to go to school, and humans leveled up, and humans leveled up, and humans leveled up. And we can keep leveling up, but you do have to decide, like, this is not okay. And I think for that realization to happen on a profound level is important, but it should be encouraging that even though you are seeing something that's problematic and you're seeing it for the first time, it's been there. It's been there for thousands of years, and how profound that you get to be alive right now when this is the leveling up that we get to do. And I believe that, like, because of our access to one another, the fact that the three of us can be on a call And this kind of conversations can continue on a global scale at a ridiculously fast pace. We get to keep leveling up as humanity at a rate that I think is exponential. It took people a lot to have these kinds of conversations that set light bulbs spurring, you know, all around the world 500 or 600 years ago, you know, onwards. Like, and so I think that we're a part of something, not just in this, but as people alive right now in the world that get to continue to change things, but you don't get to lean back and be like, wow, how cool is that? Like, it's your discomfort and your frustration with stuff. It's not just like, you know, this, you know, crappy state you have to live in. Like, it is like the juice. It's what keeps it moving. The other thing I would want to say is that all those things I just mentioned, like smoking and voting and going to school, humans got to level up, and it does matter how much you care about it and how much we all think like this can't stand, like we can't live like this. But in most of those situations, there was some sort of system change or a policy or a law that also was needed to support that change actually happening. And so recently, another conversation that kind of helped me was like, it was only a couple weeks ago, I was in a backyard gathering, and somebody was like, you've been at 1146 for a while now. Are you guys getting closer to like ending that thing? How long have you guys been around? 18 years. Are you guys close? And it was like, do people care enough? Was one of the questions he asked. And he was like, do enough people finally care enough? And I had this realization of like, more people could definitely care more. But at a certain point, you reach this threshold at which people do care, but we have to change the systems and we have to change the laws. Right. And some of that is frankly a little bit jargony or boring or something, and you need to be supporting those conversations. And you can't lean in on 100% of the system change conversations happening in the world, but you gotta grow a little bit of a stomach for that goes beyond caring. In trafficking right now, for example, there's a national committee of experts that were invited that at a federal level to consult on child sex trafficking. And they recently came out with a report that had 35-ish recommendations, very practical for how states could fight trafficking. And reading that and learning about it, we're on the committee, so I had a help in my coworker explaining it to me. But it put some light bulbs on for me of like, like when a child welfare call is made in a state, when somebody sees something that's sketchy and they make a call, does the person screening that call have the ability to mark that case as a possible trafficking case? Are they asking any questions that would help them clarify if that youth is at risk of trafficking? Because if they're not, we're missing trafficking. If we know kids who are in juvenile detention are at significant risk of having already experienced trafficking or moving out in a place where they are vulnerable to trafficking, but we're not reaching them with prevention education, that's like evidence-based prevention education, we're missing an opportunity to intervene in really critical spots. So me sitting in my living room or walking around my street or going to the grocery store and like really having a heart for this, it does matter. But it matters a lot more if I'm also moving that into understanding and supporting some of the system changes that are needed and looking into like, here's, you know, some of the messy work of like, here's state recommendations and all of those things. And that gets complicated. And I think that, you know, one more thing you can do is that I do have coworkers that are doing that job, and they're doing that job informed by the messy work happening in the lives of real children, hundreds of children in our survivor care program, and putting those recommendations together. And what allows us to kind of engage at some of those levels is donors, people giving, especially people that give monthly at any level, even if it's like $5 a month, that means money that we know is there so that we can keep doing that work. And then whenever we tell a kid, you know, we won't close a case, we can do that with not necessarily big government money and that kind of stuff, but we know we can say that because we have private grassroots individuals that say like, you can count on me. Mm.
Oh man. Okay.
And people like you all who are raising money to make sure that it can happen. So I think this campaign is a part of that as well, is making sure that some of that advocacy can happen at an informed level.
Yeah, we're trying, but I think from this conversation we could tell that there's just so much to it. It's not just going and breaking a door down and rescue and then put him in a home, end of story. There's so much. And
I mean, I think part of Defiant Hope is not mm-hmm. getting overwhelmed by that. Pace yourself. It's not a sprint. And it's not even a marathon. It's quite longer than that. And doing the little bit that you can is the most important thing. And knowing that it's all connected. It's not all, you know, if you all do, you know, I like bless you in sticking with one issue or looking at lots of issues because they are interconnected. Lots of issues impact trafficking, and trafficking is a convergence of many things that go wrong in a person's life often. Not always, but often. And so thinking about vulnerabilities in kids' lives and what are the things that are making people vulnerable. And so to care about trafficking or to figure out what your part is, mm-hmm. Anyone listening or you all, it's not only to care about the one issue, but it's knowing that there are a lot of issues related to it.
For those of us listening that are uncomfortable and irritated by the issue of child trafficking and exploitation, you should be, and not because of the pictures that you've seen, but because it's just an injustice that should not be happening, period. And fortunately, like Marilyn said, we live in an era where it's coming to light. We're beginning to understand it. We're beginning to see it. We're beginning to position ourselves in a place where we could do something about it. But at the same time, it's so complicated that sometimes it's easy for us to get overwhelmed. And sometimes when that happens, we just don't do anything, even though we care. I think the place where we can gather to begin to not just make a difference practically, but also to be able to understand some of the nuances of all this is at Love on 46. All the stuff that Marilyn shared about, you'll find on their website. If you follow them on Instagram, they share little bits and pieces. So it's not like a kick in the face every day and every moment of your life. It's just, hey, think about this aspect, think about this aspect, and then we can respond appropriately moving forward. Like she said, it's not even a marathon. It's a lifelong battle for the children who are trafficked around the world. And if you're not sure how to go about it, go to Love 146. So Marilyn, where's the best place for our listeners, for us to really be able to just connect and learn and find out how we can help on a practical level?
Love146.org. It's part of my job to make sure that what you find there helps get you through all that question. But definitely sign up for our mailing list. We don't, you know, pepper you with tons of emails, but we try to keep it really important and inspiring. And hopefully one of my goals is to never ruin your day with something really, really, really rough. Keeping it hopeful. And I mean, whatever your preferred social media spot is, you can find us there. And hopefully we're still, getting content on there that helps you engage.
All right. We're going to have all that in the show notes. Some of the times the easiest way is to donate to someone that's doing it well. And Love 146 is definitely doing it well. But I do encourage you to not stop there. Don't just throw your money at it and pretend like the solution is done. It's like, get involved. See how you may have some other crazy expertise that you don't know about that might actually benefit this cause more than you think. So learn, listen. As we kind of mentioned, we are creating this amazing design by Shin Meng. We're going to sell as many as we can and donate 100% of net proceeds to Love 146. And hopefully that'll make an impact. But I think more on the apparel side is if you wear it, I feel like it's just going to raise more conversation. But then you got to go to Love 146 to read the stories and to learn about the issue so you can have a conversation. So it's a win-win-win for everybody, hopefully. Usually we ask JD for words of wisdom, but Marilyn has given us so much today that we're going to skip over.
So much today. I got no words. Just listen to Marilyn and listen to the podcast again. There it is.
Marilyn, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for the work that you do. There you go. Thank you for listening. The audience members that are on right now, thank you for listening. We trust that you'll go out and do something with it. Let's go. Let's end this. Let's end this issue in our lifetime together. Until next time. I feel the divide between you and I, like the distance.